This is Prostate Cancer and You, a podcast produced by the Massachusetts Prostate Cancer Coalition. Mission: to educate, connect, and support men at risk, newly diagnosed individuals, survivors, and their families. It also connects organizations and professionals in Massachusetts seeking to conquer and cure prostate cancer. Hello, I'm Jordan Rich. At the 2026 MPCC Prostate Cancer Symposium, we heard from several wonderful speakers. One of the keynote presentations was by Dr. Anthony Zeitman, Shipley Professor of Radiation Oncology Emeritus, Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. He talked about the 15-year UK PROTECT study and its implications for the treatment of localized prostate cancer. Dr. Zeitman also reflected on his 40-year career as a radiation oncologist and the many advances that have occurred in the detection and treatment of the disease.
So you've heard a little introduction. So I am obviously English. You can hear my accent. I worked in medicine in England for about 8 years before moving to the United States. And I've been a prostate cancer physician really for 4 decades in total. I've had a chance to observe the prostate cancer story from PSA to the present day, 4 decades of it, on both sides of the Atlantic. And the paths we took in Britain and the USA are very, very different. I'm not going to say that either side of the Atlantic took the right path. The right path is probably a mid-Atlantic approach. But there are lots of lessons that we can learn from the way that we conducted ourselves on both sides of the Atlantic and for moving forward in the future. So that's really what I want to share with you today. It's kind of a historical perspective. Prostate cancer history sort of starts in the 1980s. Yes, prostate cancer was known about for a century before that, but really, there was very little research. Very few advances. In the early 1900s, there were some attempts at surgical removal of the prostate that did not end very well. There were some attempts at radiation treatment in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s that again, were not particularly successful. But it wasn't until PSA was discovered and found to be a marker of prostate cancer that we could discover prostate cancer early. And there are a lot of downstream consequences of that. So prostate cancer history sort of begins in the 1980s. And we've gone through a four-era story. It began with the PSA revolution. And it was followed by a decade or two of what Alan Greenspan might have called irrational exuberance, when we thought we were going to find every prostate cancer case early, treat everyone, cure everyone, and eradicate prostate cancer as a fatal disease. And we got kind of carried away in that. We did go too far, certainly in the United States. And then beyond the exuberance, there was a pushback. There was a pushback from patients. There was a pushback from physicians. There was a pushback from payers. And there was a huge unraveling of enthusiasm and excitement that took place in the third decade of this era. Now, I'm delighted to tell you that here we are in 2026, and there's been a wonderful emergence of evidence and a sort of re-equilibration. We've found our balance. We know how to move into the future, but we certainly span around on this side of the Atlantic for several decades before we became settled. So a lot of what I'm going to tell you is described by something that many of you will be familiar with. This is the very famous hype curve that was developed by the Gartner Consulting Agency. And it describes how, following the introduction of technologies, particularly in healthcare, there is a huge spike in interest, media attention, investment, that leads to a peak of almost inflated expectations. Then you may learn a little bit more about your treatments or your new technology. And then there's a crash in confidence leading to the so-called trough of disillusionment. And ultimately, through all this, evidence is developed. There is some people will be doing thoughtful study and you'll recover on the slope of enlightenment to the plateau of productivity. And I think we're going to see this a lot in the prostate cancer story. But for almost everyone who's on this um, on this webinar today. I think we're at the plateau of productivity phase, I'm pleased to say. So let's talk a little bit about the technology trigger. It was the PSA revolution. There was remarkably little research in prostate cancer until the 1980s. PSA was discovered not because people were looking for a marker for prostate cancer. It was discovered because it was going to be a tool in sexual assault investigations. But somebody called Thomas Stamey in California recognized that there was a relationship between the PSA level and the presence or absence of cancer in patients. And the higher the PSA level, the more likely there was to be cancer. And the higher still the PSA level, the greater the amount of cancer. This is what we now call a biomarker. So PSA, Stamey noted in the 1980s that PSA could be a great little biomarker. And the discovery of PSA coincided with something else. And that was the use of transrectal ultrasound. Many of you will have been through that, an ultrasound-guided biopsies. Prior to the 1980s, biopsies had been terribly random and a bit of a mess and a hit and miss. All of a sudden, they could be accurate. So you had a new marker, a great method for biopsying, and before you knew it, people were talking about screening, following the mammogram model that had been successfully rolled out in breast cancer. So the idea was that we would screen, every man over the age of, say, 50 would receive regular PSA tests. Prostate cancer would be found early using ultrasound-guided biopsies. Then everyone would be treated and prostate cancer would be eliminated. Now, there was a great deal of enthusiasm for this, and it was particularly touted by people in my specialty, radiation oncology and urology. And we really did devoutly believe this. There were reasons to believe that we could do this. It seemed logical. The radical prostatectomy had been updated as an operation. You've probably all heard of Patrick Walsh, the great Johns Hopkins surgeon. And he'd worked out how to do the prostatectomy in an anatomic fashion, such that the likelihood of incontinence was much less. And that there was really a reasonable chance that men would keep their erections. So that seemed to make treatment much less of a threat than it had been previously. Radiation therapy was also improving in many ways. There was the development of linear accelerators, targeted radiation, the use of CT scans in targeting, seed therapy, and all these other things, all very exciting. And we were all kind of carried away. But it wasn't just the urologists and the radiation oncologists who were carried away. There were a lot of other drivers around this. The PSA revolution coincided with the birth of the internet, and patients got together, formed groups. They used various search engines. They found a lot of information on the burgeoning internet. They also found a lot of advertising, because device manufacturers and hospitals were advertising aggressively online. So one thing reinforced another. And of course, I've got to say this, because it would be a denial if I didn't. There were financial drivers. You know, all of a sudden, we went from a small number of prostate cancer cases every year to hundreds of thousands. And radiation oncologists and urologists were doing very nicely out of this disease and treating this disease. And it was hard to, when you have a financial stake in this, it makes it more difficult to assess the evidence when the evidence comes in. There were also legal drivers. The belief was that everyone needed screening all the time and treatment was absolutely mandatory. It was so hardwired in the American system that physicians were getting sued for not doing screening or not treating. So a kind of protective medicine also emerged. I just want to say a little bit about medical advertising. It's very unique to the United States. It didn't happen in Britain. It's forbidden in most European nations. But it does drive a great, you see adverts on TV, you now see them on the internet. Now, maybe with the internet, we're all going to receive adverts wherever we live in the world, and this will become a global issue. But there is no doubt that advertising can be very convincing. And there are other influences, as I mentioned, the nightly news, which is always looking for good news stories, television, radio, the media of every kind, and books. So here we are. It's around 2005. We've been screening like crazy. We've been treating almost everyone in the United States who we discover with prostate cancer, no matter what the grade, no matter how early, we've been treating them all. No matter what the age, we've been treating them all. Now, there were voices saying, hang on, you might have gone too far. In Britain, for example, there was no screening throughout the 1990s or the early 2000s. None whatsoever. They were waiting for the evidence of benefit. In fact, they were looking at us here in the United States and saying, you guys have gone nuts. What are you doing? And we were looking at them and saying, you guys are ignoring this extraordinary opportunity to cure tens, hundreds of thousands of patients. So there was a tension across the Atlantic. And then worse than that, the early reports of very successful outcomes of the prostatectomy from Johns Hopkins in Chicago, of radiation therapy from my institution and from Stanford, all of a sudden, instead of asking the doctors, investigators were starting to ask the patients, what are you really experiencing? Are you having incontinence? Are you having impotence? Are you suffering from rectal bleeding? And it turned out far more of them were than we had appreciated. Why was this the case? Well, it's because in the 1990s, every radiation oncologist and every urologist tried their hand at surgery and radiation. But we weren't all great surgeons or great radiation oncologists. Not every urologist is Patrick Walsh. And many of them were not doing many cases. Those that they were doing badly. And the outcomes nationally were very poor. They were fantastic in good centers, but nationally they were very poor. And patients got to hear about this. And there were a lot of support groups. And I've attended many support groups in the early 2000s. Which were sort of complaining sessions about how badly their treatment had gone. So there were murmurings, people were meeting on the internet, and there was pushback. And there was financial pushback as well. A lot of the new treatments that were coming in for prostate cancer were very costly. Various forms of radiation were very costly. And there was a pushback from the payers saying, no, you can't have this. So then you've got patients confused. What should they do? Their physicians say one thing, the internet says another, their patients deny it anyhow. So in panic, patients fled. And we'll talk about the flight of patients in a minute. There are also some confidence-breaking issues. In 2010, the New York Times reported many of the radiation oncology centers that were installing new technology were doing so without the expertise. This was not technology being installed in the great set in the Mass Generals and the Brighams and the BIs. No, this was going into private practices and being used badly. And I'm just going to highlight one particular technology that sort of developed an internet life of its own, and that's proton therapy. Many of you may have heard about this, and I'm just going to highlight it because it's so phenomenally expensive. It requires... or it used to require an area the size of a football field to install the proton center. It cost up to $250,000. Obviously, that was money that was coming out of surgery and internal medicine. It was going into proton therapy. And for what? Well, there was an argument that proton therapy was the best treatment around for prostate cancer, the best, the most accurate, the one least likely to cause impotence or incontinence. And that gained into an internet life. And from being two proton centers in the USA in 2004, mine at Mass General was one. We were using proton beam for research, I might add. We weren't really looking to treat everyone with prostate cancer. All of a sudden, within a decade or two, there are about 50 centers across the United States, all costing vast sums of money and charging vast sums of money. And was there any evidence that that treatment was better? Well, I'm not going to say too much about it, but there was a certainly, in the early 2000s, proton beam therapy did look better than, a nationally performed surgery or nationally performed radiation. But what happens is it acquired a life of its own. Institutions liked having proton beam centers because they were prestige projects. And there was no check to this. There was no FDA scrutiny, and there was various forms of novel financing. And prostate cancer became the driver for this great expansion. Then came the pushback. First of all, in New York Times, and then a governmental level. It was described as crazy medicine and unsustainable public policy, that so much money was being invested in something without evidence. The payers pushed back. Many of you who probably were seeking proton therapy in the 2010s couldn't get it. And I'll sort of conclude that story in a minute. But a great part of the unraveling was the flight of patients. And patients were very disillusioned about 10, 20 years ago. They were saying, well, I can't trust my doctors. One doctor's saying one thing, my insurance company's saying another, the internet's saying something. What the hell am I going to do? I'll take things into my own hands. And they did. And we went through many phases. There was enthusiasm for various nutritional supplements, for soy, vitamin A. There was the sorry story of pomegranate juice, which was pushed very aggressively by the manufacturers of Pom Wonderful. They ended up being fined heavily by the FDA for over-promising. They were arguing that pomegranate juice could cure prostate cancer. Vitamin A had a great deal of traction online. There's good reason to think that vitamin A might be helpful. But when we finally did the randomized trials, it turned out not only was it not helpful, it might be actually unhelpful. It might increase the risk of prostate cancer. And soy was just, soy was very reasonable. You know, Asian men have a very low risk of prostate cancer. American men have a high risk. Asian men come to America, eat our diet, and suddenly their risk of prostate cancer goes up. So there was a lot of looking at the difference in diet, and it was thought, well, a big difference is soy. Maybe soy is protective. And it probably isn't, but it's certainly good for you for other reasons. Then we had some other really sad stories. The story of PC spares. It was marketed as a Chinese herb that would fight prostate cancer. And certainly in the early 2000s, we saw men taking this Chinese herb, and their PSAs would drop and their cancer would seem to come under control. But it turned out it wasn't a Chinese herbs. This was a product made by a small company in San Francisco that was spiked with female hormones. And also, because female hormones can cause blood clots, with a blood thinner, Coumadin, and also with something else anti-inflammatory that's dangerous on its own called indomethacin. So it was a terrible story. People went to jail. But these were the kind of straws that patients were totally understandably clutching for. But all the while in the background, through the 1990s, through the 2010s, people on both sides of the Atlantic, the United States, Britain, and also I've got to give a shout out to Sweden, were doing the serious hard work of the expensive trials to find out, is screening valuable or not? Is treatment valuable or not? And if so, which treatment? And then the new issue was active surveillance. Are there patients with prostate cancer who can be left alone safely and spared the rigors of treatment? And I'm going to just summarize this. Screening does work. It took 30 years to show it, and the effect is not as profound as we thought. We thought we would eradicate prostate cancer by catching it early. That is not the case. But we can reduce the risk of a death from prostate cancer by thoughtful screening. And that means screening men of an at-risk age, not screening men into their 80s and 90s. This is pointless. So that was an important discovery. It took a long time, but that has finally convinced the British. There was a big Swedish and Dutch trial. And even the British have started screening now. They needed evidence. Treatment works. Turns out that radiation and surgery are quite successful, but you want to be selective. They've got to be done by the best physicians possible if you want the best results. And they will reduce, but not eliminate, the risk of death from prostate cancer. It turns out they're all pretty good. All the modern forms of treatment are pretty good. without one being obviously better than another. But most importantly, active surveillance is safe. And there was a huge study that could not be done in the United States because there were too many entrenched interests, but was done in Britain called PROTECT, in which nearly 2,000 men were randomly assigned to surgery or radiation or no treatment at all, just observation and treatment down the line, maybe if it was needed. And it turned out that active surveillance is a very safe first step for many men with prostate cancer. So by using screening, by not treating absolutely everyone who is diagnosed, and by selectively treating and by treating with the best treatments possible, by the best physicians possible, actually, we're in a great place right now. So if I go back to that hype cycle and I look at PSA screening in these terms, yes, it started in the 1980s. Our peak of inflated expectations was around 2000. There was a great crash in disillusionment. There was a recommendation against screening in about 2010. And then finally, as the trial's done, we learn it's pretty useful. What happened in Britain? Well, no early screening and a slower slope of enlightenment. Oh, let's look at the radical prostatectomy. Exactly the same. A peak, a trough, and now a real plateau of productivity. In Britain, it's that curve again. Nothing in the 1990s. They were waiting for evidence, and now they've caught up. And radiation, this is just one kind of radiation. This could be IMRT, this could be SBRT, IMRT, all the other kinds of radiation. Again, the same deal. In Britain, there's a bit more enthusiasm for radiotherapy than there is for surgery. And this is just a cultural difference that is hard to explain. But you will notice, again, very few patients were being treated in Britain in the 1990s or the early 2000s. So did they lose an opportunity or did they avoid treatment they didn't need? Well, that's a question of your perspective. So what have we learnt that can take us forward? We're into the plateau of productivity now. We have learnt that prostate cancer care needs to be centralised. And you are much better off going to a big centre where they do a lot of it. Volume matters. The higher the volume, the more likely there'll be a good outcome. We've learned the importance of multidisciplinary clinics. We started these at Mass General 25 years ago. When you've got a surgeon, a radiation oncologist, a medical oncologist all together in a room, you know, I won't say we're more honest. I think we always try to be honest, but we can't escape the downsides of our treatment. And we are much more likely to come to a recommendation, say, of active surveillance for many men. The involvement of medical oncologists has been really important. It didn't start until the early 2000s. These are guys and ladies who look after advanced prostate cancer. And that's where the real advances have taken place. There was very little research in advanced prostate cancer until the medical oncologists got involved. Thankfully, they are involved. Now we are learning a huge amount and funding is being shifted from early disease, where we've kind of got our evidence now, to advanced disease, where we really need help. And I'm going to say there have been some big changes in research funding. The National Cancer Institute was very slow to catch up to breast cancer. Women were much better advocates than men. And they're catching up now, not quite there. But we're getting a lot of money from the National Cancer Institute and Department of Defense. But that's government money, so they tend to want very conservative, safe research. But there are organizations like the Prostate Cancer Foundation, you're going to hear more about that later, that are much more speculative. They treat research like venture capital. You know, sure, we'll fund 100 projects. We only need one to work. The other 99 can be busts. But they're much more speculative. So we have these two arms to research funding, government and groups like the PCF, which has really changed the landscape. And finally, I just want to say a little bit about the history of the systems in the US and the UK and why we are so different. So healthcare systems reflect the underlying values, expectations and cultures of the people they serve. So in Britain, there was kind of from Elizabethan times, there were workhouses for the poor. There was no provision for public housing or any kind of public welfare. Dickens has written a lot about this. You all remember Oliver. And then in 1911, there was the National Insurance Act. And this man, called David Lloyd George, was prime minister at that time. And David Lloyd George allowed workers in certain industries to make a contribution which would come back to them as healthcare, not their dependents, not their kids, not their parents, but came back to them. So it was an early step at health insurance. The Second World War was incredibly important because it followed the Great Depression. And the whole nation had rallied together. Everyone, you know, whatever your class, had fought together in the military service. There was a belief that Britain should be, you know, a land fit for heroes. So in 1945, I won't say too much about Beveridge, but in 1945, there was a huge election. And everyone thought Winston Churchill, the war hero, would win. But no, the winners were the Labour Party, who promised the so-called welfare state to look after the returning heroes. They had some socialist ideas, which ultimately did not help the British economy. But they did create the welfare state, of which the nation remains pretty proud. And the idea of the nation state was that the British people would be cared for from cradle to grave and kept away from the five great evils of society, one of which is disease. In 1948, the National Health Service was founded. It was pushed by this, another Welshman, a Welsh miner who became the Minister for Health. His name was Aneurin Bevin. And the idea was that all hospitals would become government-owned and services would be free from the point of use and paid for by central taxation, which means if it's paid for by taxation, there's a limit. So everyone's eligible for care, but they're not eligible for all kinds of care. And the idea was that care would be nationally standardized and elevated. And they created a body called the National Institute for Clinical Efficiency, which was led by this man, Michael Rawlins, which was going to look at all the evidence. And before a new drug or a new technology can be instituted or screening, it had to have some evidence. Otherwise, it wasn't going to be used. So this is the principal reason why there was such a slow ramp up in Britain. Now, you can argue this was a wonderful thing because it avoided a waste of taxpayers' money, or you could argue it, you know, Britons were denied in the 1990s some health opportunities which they could have otherwise had. That's your perspective. Michael Rawlins was highlighted, and the National Institute for Clinical Efficiency, known as NICE, was highlighted by Sarah Palin in the 2007 presidential election, yes. McCain and Penn. These were the so-called death panels that that she talked about. The US healthcare system emerged very differently. There was a little project in the 1920s in which Baylor Hospital and the local teachers came together. And the idea was that teachers would pay a certain amount of money, they could get it back as healthcare. And during the war, there was a shortage of workers, but there was a wage freeze. And so health insurance became used as an employer benefit on the Baylor Hospital model. And following the war, private for-profit insurance became the norm in the United States, which is fine. And in the 1970s, it peaked at 70% coverage of the US population. But of course, that left about 100 million people uncovered. And it was Lyndon Johnson's sort of great society vision. He had a two-chamber majority. Together with Wilbur Mills, who's the head of the House Ways and Means, powerful House Ways and Means Committee, he created Medicare for the elderly and Medicaid for the poor. But there were some flaws in Medicare, and this is how Wilbur Mills got this through the American Medical Association. It was a fee-for-service system, unlike in Britain where it was salaried. And physicians were paid their usual and customary rates, whatever they were, whatever they wanted to charge. And Medicare was legislated to not negotiate price nor limit physicians, which was made it far more acceptable for physicians in the earlier days. I mean, there are attempts now to limit physicians, but it's difficult. America could have gone on to universal healthcare if it wasn't for the death of Johnson, the Vietnam War, which took attention elsewhere. And of course, for those of you old enough to remember Fanny Fox, the Argentinian firecracker, the stripper who was found with a drunk Wilbur Mills in the early 1970s. And that was the end of his career and his push for universal healthcare. So we have two national characters reflecting two very different healthcare systems. The American system is market-based. It has no budget, you know, whatever it is, nearly 18% of the American capital expenditure is in healthcare. It is innovative. And this is what we love America for. It is innovative. It's rapidly rewarding for the doctors. You don't need much more than a little bit of FDA approval and you're off. You're in the marketplace. You can use, you can advertise. It's incredibly nimble. New devices come in quickly. The system can change on a dime. And this means that in the United States, we tend to rush things into use. And perhaps we overuse them at first. But so long as evidence is being gathered, we can dial it back in the future. Boom, bust, reset. In Britain, with its national health care system, which has a strict budget capped at about 8 or 9% of the national budget goes to health, there has to be a barrier. So there is rigorous evidence-driven criteria for any new therapy. But of course, it can lead to constraint. But one thing NICE have done in Britain is they are forced to do the randomized trials, the difficult trials, surgery versus radiation, active surveillance versus treatment, that can't be done in the United States. The United States does tweaking trials, you know, radiation A versus radiation B, this kind of surgery versus that kind of surgery, but doesn't do the big picture trials. But together, they complement one another. So America, the American system, we here in the USA, early adopters, we adopt ahead of evidence. We often get it right. We sometimes get it spectacularly wrong. Boom, bust, appropriate use. Britain, slow adopters. We await mature evidence. What if that takes decades to come? The British patients are being denied care. They're late starters, but a slow rise to appropriate use. So Britain and the United States actually in 2026 aren't very far apart. We've finally gotten to the same place in our different lanes. So what's our lesson for today? Well, both sides of the Atlantic serve very important and complementary roles because of their differences. Britain can do the trials. Britain acts as a brake on the United States. United States shows Britain what trials to do. And the United States is an innovator. So as Prince Charles had to explain to Donald Trump relatively recently, this is a transatlantic alliance that is really very special and very complementary to both sides. And the reason we are in such a good state in 2026 is because of the two lanes, the two nations, and I'm going to throw in Sweden as well, the various sides of the Atlantic have taken. So the ultimate best approach is a mid-Atlantic approach.
I invite you to stay tuned for future podcasts featuring valuable information and resources, the latest in research and treatment, and stories of real people who have challenged prostate cancer and won. To learn more about the Massachusetts Prostate Cancer Coalition and to hear the Prostate Cancer In You podcast, go to masspcc.org. That's masspcc.org. You can also listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, and with all Android players. This is Jordan Rich wishing you a fabulous day.